Hello, it's John Dennis on Thursday the 13th of August. Today, the family of a security guard accused of shooting dead two men in Baghdad say he won't get a fair trial in Iraq.
As you might imagine, he is a very concerned and somewhat confused man. He's been processed.
Also today, the fears of young people of a life on the dole.
I've been unemployed now since Christmas. I work in the building trade and it's the worst I've known it really since the early 90s recession.
Hospitals are on alert over a group of deadly new superbugs. And David Byrne talks to us about making a building into a musical instrument.
I thought it seemed obvious. I was kind of surprised that no one else had done it.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a flick through the papers with Bill Overton.
The man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing is likely to be freed on compassionate grounds next week. The Libyan Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi, who has terminal prostate cancer, is serving life for murdering 270 people in 1988. It was reported last night the Scottish Justice Secretary, Kenny McCaskill, has told the Libyan government to make preparations for Megrahi's imminent release and to arrange his flight home. Children as young as 12 are being wrongly imprisoned in England and Wales, according to the charity Barnardo's. Its report says confusion over the criteria for youth courts led to more than 165 under-15s wrongly being given custodial sentences in 2007. The Ministry of Justice says detention should be the last resort, with judges having the final say. But the report finds more than a third of cases of 12 to 14-year-olds being locked up didn't meet the conditions. President Barack Obama has awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest US civilian honour, to 16 people praised as agents of change. Recipients included the South African human rights champion Archbishop Desmond Tutu and British scientist Stephen Hawking. A posthumous medal was awarded to US gay rights activist Harvey Milk. Now let's have a look at today's papers, and The Sun leads with armed robbery as it reveals the £40 million Mayfair gem robbers wore latex disguises to hide their identities during the heist. The Mirror picks up the story, saying the jewels are believed to have been stolen to order and now smuggled abroad. The Telegraph leads on Tory frontbencher Alan Duncan after he was filmed complaining about MPs' reduced standards of living following the expenses scandal. The paper says Duncan's future as shadow leader of the House is now in doubt after senior Tories took a dim view of his remarks. The Express headline is one in five young people jobless, saying Labour has created a new lost generation of jobless youths. New statistics reveal almost a million under-25s are now looking for work. And all the papers have pictures of England's Jermaine Defoe, whose two goals pulled his team level in the friendly against Holland last night. Don't forget there's more news and breaking stories throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The family of a British security guard accused of killing two colleagues in Iraq want him to be tried in the UK. Former paratrooper Danny Fitzsimons, who's 29, is accused of shooting dead fellow Briton Paul McGuigan and Australian Darren Hoare. He could be the first foreigner to be publicly executed in Iraq. John Tipple is Fitzsimons' legal caseworker. He's spoken by telephone to Fitzsimons, who's in jail in Baghdad.
We would need to go back a long way if we were going to remedy the situation as it is in Iraq today, wouldn't we? Because there's been an illegal war, and the mess that's left behind it is incredible. And the very idea that a British subject would get any kind of justice out there, especially given our client's history with the British Armed Forces, is also incredible. We do not trust the Iraqi authorities, and we want to see our client back in the UK and stand trial here so he can answer to his peers.
But nevertheless, the very serious offences that Mr. Fitzsimons is accused of did happen on Iraqi soil. Shouldn't they have the right to try a suspect under their own system?
Well, we challenge whether it is a viable system in any case, but no would be my answer to that. Since 1861, there's been statute in this country that makes provision to try people here. And we have established a legal system in this country by serious effort and by making sure that the law is as sound as possible. None of that process has taken place in Iraq. It's in this country that the law has been tested, and it's in this country that Daniel should be tried.
You've spoken to Mr. Fitzsimons. What's his mood at the moment?
As you might imagine, he is a very concerned and somewhat confused man. He's been processed, And that process is not only intimidating, as you might imagine, because he clearly knows the consequences. Everybody saw Saddam Hussein being strung up and the farce that that was. And for those of us who do not believe in hanging or capital punishment, looking at what goes on in Iraq is abhorrent.
What sort of assistance are you getting from the security company that employed Mr. Fitzsimons?
I can tell you that I consider that that company has a duty of care. And if they look past their corporate image, then they should show humanity and a duty of care to Daniel Fitzsimons. And they should facilitate his defence, including the request that we've made to them directly, which is to be flown out to Baghdad today, because clearly my client is in a state of confusion and is getting legal advice from who knows and what qualifications do these people have. We need to get professionals out there to help him properly.
Does Mr. Fitzsimons' family believe that he was in a fit mental state to take what must have been a very stressful job working for a security company in Baghdad?
When Daniel Fitzsimons was in the parachute regiment, is when he was damaged there through effectively post-traumatic stress disorder. And he clearly had that when he was in the British Army.
And so you think that possibly not, possibly he wasn't in a fit mental state really to take such a stressful job?
I think that is a serious question you've asked here, and I think the answer to it is, according to the information that's before me, no, he's not.
Are you getting much assistance or any assistance from the British Foreign Office in your attempts to get him tried in the UK?
I am actually having some, you know, very good contact with the Foreign Office, and I've expressed my concerns to them, and they have concerns themselves. But we've handed over to the Iraqi authorities, whoever they are, and whatever credibility they may have. It certainly is not a satisfactory situation, but they've handed over to them. And this is a consequence of the whole debacle of the Iraqi war. And our client is going to be used as a scapegoat. That is our real fear, that he gets treated because of the hatred that the British Army and British forces in general have clearly earned themselves.
John Tipple, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Iraq. Also on The Guardian's website today, The Many Sides of Arthur Ransom by John Henley, guardian.co.uk/books. Erwin James, a former prisoner himself, on How We All Love a Good Heist, guardian.co.uk/crime. And Brian Logan on Comedians Doing Drama, guardian.co.uk/culture. Unemployment jumped 220,000 in the 3 months to June. The total figure is now 2.4 million. That's 7.8% of the workforce. It's at the highest level since 1995. These are the views of job seekers in Islington in North London.
I've been on the dole for about, a year now. So, it's a bit tough. But, you know, I'm surviving. I'm a survivor. There is jobs out there. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm looking at a certain rate of money, which can, so I can come off the dole. So if I get a job, say, around about £8, I'll come off the dole, because right now I can't, you know, the national minimum wage is about £5 something, and that ain't going to cover me. So I'm just waiting. And there is a chance of me getting something. I just got to keep on there and be out there every day looking, you know.
I've been unemployed now since Christmas. I work in the building trade, and it's the worst I've known it really since the early 90s recession. But things seem to be picking up slowly on the upturn now. So I'm hopeful, more than I was 3 months ago anyway. Yeah, and I'm getting a lot of help from these guys in here actually, so it's quite good, yeah.
I'm actually looking for work in the schools. Being a lone parent, I have to look for the term times and obviously summer holidays. Especially with this new thing they're bringing out income support. When the child hits seven, you have to be employed, otherwise they're going to stop your benefits.
The views of job seekers in Islington in North London. Our economics correspondent, Ashley Seeger, says youth unemployment is particularly worrying.
Yes, this has been a feature of the data for a while, but people are waking up to just how bad it is. Of, for example, the drop in employment over the past year, which is always worth looking at, as well as the rise in unemployment. Over half of that's been down to the under 25s. Of the 2.5 million people, 2.45 million people now unemployed, fully 1 million of those are under 25.
I suppose the fear is that when people leave school or leave education and can't find a job, that they'll just remain unemployed.
That's always the fear, and surveys show always that a spell of unemployment for a young person does them much more damage than a spell of unemployment does for a middle-aged person or an older person, because if you don't get into that workforce, you have no experience of it. You've come out of school being told you've got to get a job, and then you don't get one. And these are called permanent scars on young people. And that's why all the talk today is of a lost generation, because once young people are out of work for a while, they find it very, very difficult to get into work.
Now, what do these latest unemployment figures tell us about the prospects for recovery?
Well, unemployment's always considered by economists to be a lagging indicator. That means that if an economy turns down, it takes a while and there's a lag before unemployment rises, and vice versa in recovery. So even if the economy now has stopped getting worse and the Bank of England's telling us today that we should start to recover soon, unemployment could well be rising for another year to easily 3 million, possibly 3.5.
Mervyn King, the Bank of England governor, said yesterday that he did think that the recovery in the UK economy could be quite slow, though.
Yes, I think that's right. And that's what I asked him about at the press conference, was that their diagrams of growth show a rapid rebound. And I said, well, that looks a bit optimistic given what you're saying. And he said, well, actually, you know, don't be fooled by the diagram. You know, there's a lot of challenges to this economy. The banking system is still in real trouble. People are carrying too much debt they've got to work off. The government's got too big a deficit it's got to work off. So in general, this could be a very slow affair, and people shouldn't be fooled by the fact we've had some good data recently. It just means we've stopped getting worse.
Ashley Seeger. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, we hear from the musician, artist, filmmaker and writer David Byrne about his latest project, a remarkable sound installation. But first, hospitals have been put on alert about a group of new superbugs. They've been brought into the UK by patients who've had surgery abroad, including cosmetic treatments and organ transplants. The virulent new strains of drug-resistant bacteria are much harder for doctors to tackle than MRSA or C. difficile. So far, they've killed 2 people and left 18 others seriously ill. The Observer's health correspondent, Dennis Campbell, has the details.
These are a group of new superbugs, 4 of them called carbapenem-resistant infections or bacteria. Carbapenems are the major class of usually super effective, potent antibiotics, which the NHS relies on to treat the most serious virulent infections. The trouble with these superbugs, the new ones, are that they're pretty much resistant to them, so the NHS is really in a quandary about what to do.
What can they do?
Well, treatment options are pretty limited. The NHS is taking, in effect, pretty desperate measures. They are using, they've brought back into circulation specifically for this purpose, antibiotics which haven't been used for 20 years, some of which were in effect binned because they had potentially dangerous side effects. The main one that they're using for this was discarded for use some time ago because they were worried about sort of neurotoxicity of it. The situation is so serious, i.e. the risk of death to certain patients, that they've had to bring up old ones that have been hiding away in dusty boxes and also use drugs that are still in development. The situation is that desperate. They are that desperate to try and keep people alive and reduce the risk of injury, that they're trying basically anything that goes, because all standard antibiotics are proving ineffective.
And is there anything they can do to sort of get the drug companies to do some research and produce something new that will be effective in tackling these bugs?
One of the senior people at the Health Protection Agency, Dr. David Livermore, has told us that, you know, he really, really, really wants drug companies to start producing antibiotics that will actually prove effective against what are known as a general class of infections as gram-negative bacteria. They've got plenty of antibiotics to treat more routine infections. There's a growing number of these gram-negative bacteria, which are basically resistant to all antibiotics. I spoke to the editor of The Lancet Infectious Diseases, who said the government should actually basically offer financial incentives to the drug companies to produce things. The medical need, the clinical need is so urgent that the government should, in effect, subsidise drug companies to produce them because we don't have them. The NHS urgently, desperately needs them.
David Byrne, best known for being the singer with Talking Heads, is in London at the moment. He's behind Playing the Building, a sound installation that's turned the Camden Roundhouse into a musical instrument. Visitors are encouraged to play a pump organ with each key connected to a different part of the building, producing a noise. He spoke to The Guardian's Rosie Swash.
I thought it seemed obvious, and I was kind of surprised that no one else had done it, to propose that just attaching kind of mechanical devices to bits of a building, an old building like that, and have them make noise, all just controlled by a controller, in this case an old pump organ where the keys have been modified, so they're basically a series of switches, and the public is invited to come in and play the thing. It was not really a performance or show that people come in to watch or appreciate, but something where the public becomes part of it, or they participate in something they do, rather than something that they watch. The Roundhouse, a lot of people will know it from performances and things, and it has all these great arch supports and hollow metal columns and things like that, that are kind of perfect for this kind of thing.
Your album, most recent album, Everything That Happens, saw you returning to what I suppose is your longest standing collaborative partner with Brian Eno. Mm-hmm. What is it about him and working with him that keeps you going back over the years?
Well, we share other interests besides music, so that allows us to sort of get along. We don't just talk about music.
So you are buddies as well?
Yeah, we can do that. If we can hang out as well. We can chat over dinner. He calls himself a non-musician, although he actually can play in a certain kind of way fairly well. But he mostly thinks as a non-musician, which allows him to some extent to step back from what he's doing and not get wrapped up in the technique of fingering or chords or the things that musicians tend to kind of overly focus on, and he can kind of step back and actually hear what's happening, or think about the big picture, think about the structure of the music or the texture of it, and he thinks in those kind of terms.
David Byrne talking to Rosie Swash, and you can see David Byrne playing the Roundhouse, as it were, at guardian.co.uk/music. Phil Maynard and Ian Chambers were the producers of today's programme. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.